Hello and welcome to the Thinky Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and a guest today, John Hoyam. We are going to be doing an episode here on Gerhard Ferdi. But before we jump into the topic today, I'd like to thank people who have helped us cross the 500 review mark, and we keep going up past that.
I didn't even know we'd crossed it.
And I think we actually said this a couple episodes back that we passed it, but
I was paying attention.
But obviously, you know, it's notable, and we've had a lot of help doing this. You know, reviews on iTunes are one of the ways that listeners who are looking to support the show in one way or another can do that, because it makes the show more discoverable, not just on Apple Podcasts, but on, you know, a plethora of podcasting platforms as they take Apple's library and then reuse it on their own platforms. So it's been a great help, and it's also fun to read through it and just see sort of the positive remarks that people have from the show and the different ways that the show has helped or affected or encouraged people. And so, again, thank you for sharing that with us. We've also been getting some emails. We had a couple emails about topic suggestions. I had asked for those a couple weeks ago. We will get around to those. The nature of the show has changed in the last couple weeks, as I'm sure the nature of most people's lives have changed with COVID. I know that probably many of our listeners have been impacted negatively, whether they've lost work or a spouse or family member has lost work or somebody's gotten ill. And, you know, we pray for all those who are affected, and we hope that during this time, as we uptick our content and as we shift content towards helping people or encouraging people who are at home, that that can be utilized. So let's jump into today's episode. John, do you want to give people an introduction? You write for the 1517 blog, so maybe people have seen your name on the website before, but who are you? What do you do? What do you study? What's up?
What's up?
Yeah, so I'm serving now as the pastor of Denny Park Lutheran Church, which is just off downtown Seattle on the north side of things. I'm a recent graduate of Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And before that, I went to Bethel University, which is a small liberal arts college in St. Paul as well. Right now, while I'm doing ministry stuff full-time, I'm also working on a doctorate at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. And that's a distance learning program. So I try to stay busy. And then, of course, writing for 1517 is a welcome distraction from everything else too.
What's the subject of your doctorate?
So I'm writing on the 20th and early 21st century Lutheran theologian Robert Jensen, who taught for many years at the Lutheran Seminary in Gettysburg. He wrote numerous books, was a prolific essayist, and a fairly critical figure in the early years of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. He's an interesting figure, and so I've gone to work studying him, and particularly how he understands the doctrine of the church.
He's a co-author of the systematic theology that was used in the ELCA for years and years, Broughton Jensen, right?
That's right, yeah, which is actually a good segue into the Ferdi topic, because Jensen and his longtime co-conspirator, Carl Broughton, put together in the mid-1980s a two-volume Dogmatics that was an edited work. So it brought in various different authors to write on the different doctrinal topics of Christian systematic theology. And that was in use for many, many years in the ELCA.
And Ferdi wrote for that at some point, right? A couple of the chapters?
Yeah, Ferdi wrote for that, probably most notably on the Atonement.
Right. Okay.
So I think the opening question here is, I said in the introduction that Ferdi is going to be the topic of the show, and some listeners may recognize his name. We have mentioned books of his on the show. We have done an entire show on his book on being a theologian of the cross. We did that in lead up to our conference 2 years ago, and so people might be aware, but you know, he's a bit of a controversial figure in modern Lutheranism. And so a lot of people have questions about him because they will hear mixed things about Ferdi. And so I figured out we'd do a little bit of history, maybe context of Ferdi, who he was writing to, what church he was a part of, things that people who are just aware of him sort of being spoken of might not know for themselves. So where do we start here with the history of Ferdy becoming, you know, somebody who writes Lutheran theology?
I mean, I'd be interested to know. I know very little about, I know a little about his sort of his history and education, but from what you told me, John's done some study on that. I'd like to sort of know his influences. Where was he schooled? Who were his major academic theological influences as he was coming up?
Yeah, I think that's actually a great way to approach the issue of Ferdy and some of the controversial things that kind of end up getting said about him. I think the background of Ferdy's life, his education, the churches that he was a part of, I think that that all sheds some light and context on who he was and the nature of the kind of theology that he did. So Ferdy was born in 1927 in central Minnesota. His father was a Lutheran pastor at a rural parish there. And actually his grandfather had also been the pastor there. So this particular congregation had been served by Ferdy's for decades. So Ferdy originally went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And his first interest was chemistry. He also served in the military during this time. So he'd go to seminary until a little bit later. So after Luther College and sort of giving up on a career in the sciences, he ended up going to Luther Seminary or Luther Theological Seminary in St. Paul, which, of course, is where I myself went.
Why did he give up on the sciences, John?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I have a suspicion that he probably wanted to differentiate from his father's and his grandfather's vocation in ministry. But as oftentimes happens,
Get sucked into it anyway.
You run away from the call for a little while, and then and then God pulls you back into it, whether you like it or not,
or just plain old guilt.
Exactly. Especially with the Scandinavians.
Yeah. It was interesting to me because some of my favorite theologians started out life in the sciences, in the hard sciences. And I tend to think it makes for a better theologian, usually, somebody who actually tries to track down evidence from the scriptures alone rather than all sorts of other places.
It's one of the things that you'll notice about Ferdy's writing is he has a sort of precision about him. He has a nimble mind and a creative way of expressing ideas. He's also brief in the way that he writes. He doesn't write long, long, long books. He gets to the point. And I think that you could arguably say that that probably has a connection to the scientific mind, the desire for clarity of expression and briefness, being able to express yourself clearly and succinctly.
His longest books are books that were edited and published after his death, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you have a number of different collections of his works that have been published, towards the end of his life, and then following his death as well. But those are mostly collections of essays and some book chapters and things like that.
Cool. All right, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I think an important thing about Ferdy to bring is his church affiliation. So, of course, by the end of his life, he was serving at Luther Seminary as retired out of the chair of systematic theology there. So by the time he died, LCA, this was in 2005, LCA had become embroiled in a number of different controversies about various things.
So the LCA, is the Lutheran Church in America, right?
Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Yeah, formed by the merger of a number of different other Lutheran denominations in 1988, and has a bit of a reputation for being the liberal or more progressive denomination in the Lutheran landscape in America.
And what church bodies came together to do that? And when that was formed, was Ferdy part of what church body was he part of before this?
So Ferdy was originally born into what was known as the ELC or the Evangelical Lutheran Church. which was itself a conglomeration or merger of various different Norwegian American Lutheran churches. Those churches joined together with other German Lutherans in particular to form what was known as the ALC in the early 1960s. So then by the time you get to the ELCA, you have the ALC, the American Lutheran Church. You also have the Lutheran Church in America, which has more of an, or had more of an East Coast base. And then you also had the AELC. And those were the churches that had left the Missouri Synod during the Seminex controversy. So during the course of the 80s, they felt very inclined to join together into one church body and try to merge. And that's where the ELCA came. So by the end of his life, actually been a member of a number of different Lutheran synods and had been carried along as the mergers happened successively.
So the merger of those different denominations eventually too created the largest Lutheran denomination in America, right? The ELCA.
Right.
Yeah. Which is subsequently in 2000, you can correct me, John, I think it's 2010 when the big break happened again, where NALC and North American Lutheran Church and the LCMC, Lutheran Congregations and Missions for Christ, pulled out of the ALCA?
Yeah, that's right. So there was a fateful decision in 2009 in the ELCA, which was a decision to give the option to congregations to call practicing gays and lesbians as pastors. So, of course, a lot of the more conservative and confessional elements within the ELCA dissented from that position. And so that is what ended up resulting in the formation of the North American Lutheran Church, which is the denomination that I am affiliated with by ordination. So about 10 years before that, you also had a formation of an association of Lutheran churches called Lutheran Congregations and Mission for Christ. And they had sort of broken off from the ELCA for somewhat different reasons, but the NALC and the LCMC sort of make common cause in that way and sort of take up the mantle of, you might say, a centrist sort of Lutheran voice in America. That's not the best term. It's not my favorite term either, but that would probably be the right way to characterize those churches that left the ELCA but did not go all the way and simply join the Missouri Synod, for example.
Yeah. Okay, so when we left off with Ferdy, he went to Luther Northwestern Seminary as a student. So what happens after that?
So Ferdy left to do doctoral work at Harvard with a Reform scholar named Heiko Obermann. And Ferdy studied Harvard. So Ferdy produced a book from that Harvard dissertation in 1969 called The Law-Gospel Debate. What this book is, it's a history of the distinction of law and gospel in the Lutheran tradition. So he starts with the Reformation, moves through the period of Lutheran orthodoxy, talks about the 19th century, and then engages with some more modern figures like Karl Barth, who was a notable critic of the Sir Lutheran way of talking about law and gospel and the difference between the two.
So he gets a doctorate at Harvard?
He gets a doctorate at Harvard.
Okay, doctorate at Harvard.
That's... And in 1964, he takes a position teaching church history at Luther Seminary. So his original area of study was history, but he had a what you might call a systematic bent early on. So Ferdy was trained as a historian, but was interested in the systematic questions and problems that are presented by the history of the Lutheran Church. And so he ended up writing a number of significant books that were really more in the field of what you would call systematic theology. So you have books like Where God Meets Man. He has a book on justification. He has a short systematic theology called Theologies for Proclamation. And then, of course, a book that we talk about a fair amount at 1517 is his book on the Heidelberg Disputation.
So it's interesting. You said that Ferdy went to study at Harvard under Heiko Obermann, who, when I was coming up, I had a friend who went to go study under Heiko Obermann at the University of Arizona when Heiko was there before he died. But Ferdy was older than Heiko Obermann. That's interesting.
Yeah, so Ferdy was born in 1927. I don't know the birth year for Obermann.
It looks like it's 1930, which that's interesting to me. Now, I mean, I don't think a lot of people, Heiko Obermann's work isn't probably well-known popularly, but if you're a Reformation historian or Reformation theologian, you'd be very familiar with Heiko Obermann, mainly maybe just through so many of his students, too, that he sort of sent on who's done, you know, other work that's been very influential, and he himself too. I guess I didn't realize that Ferdy did his PhD under Heiko Obermann. That's interesting to me.
Makes the historical bent make some sense too, in regards to sort of, you know, searching out a history of Luther and Luther's ideas, since Obermann's biography of Luther is sort of well known as one of the,
well, as is his book on medieval theology. It's got a weird name. It's like the harvest
of medieval theology.
Yeah. I mean, it's just he's well known in those circles. It's just interesting to me. I wouldn't have guessed that just off the bat, just because of Ferdy's influences seem sort of different than Obermann's.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about Ferdy's influences?
Yeah, let's do that.
Scott, I know this is a question that your teacher, Jim Nestigan, has written about, the question of Ferdy's influences. And oftentimes, one of the ways that is used to legitimize or size a thinker is reading and who did they agree with,
sure,
who influenced them. And as Jim and as you out, it's often tricky to identify influence. But I would say that two of the important aspects of influence would include his old Norwegian-American Lutheran background, which went back to a church known as the Norwegian Synod. And the other aspect would be the 20th century Scandinavian Luther Renaissance.
Yeah.
So, to deal with the one of those, Ferdy from a group of Norwegian Lutherans who emigrated to the United States in the middle of the 19th century. And they came to the U.S. and were reasonably loyal to the Church of Norway and that whole tradition. They were known for being more on the high church side, but they were also influenced by pietism in some significant ways. And so they were also known for their passion and preaching, their emphasis on sort of living faith, an enthusiasm for evangelism. But at the same time, they were also very influenced by the renewal of confessional Lutheran theology that was going on in Europe in the 19th century. And so Ferdy himself was sort of descended from this group of Norwegian Lutherans who came to America. When they got here, they were immediately set up with C.F.W. Walther and with the Missouri Synod. So the Norwegian Synod ended up actually joining what was known as the Synodical Conference, because this particular synod was known steadfastly confessional, so staunch in its Lutheranism.
It's funny, when I was at Oxford, I stopped by Mansfield College mainly because Jim told me that Ferdy had served there as a tutor for at least a couple terms. I don't know how long. Might even been a couple of years, which is just interesting to me. Mansfield College in Oxford is, as far as I know, one of the only colleges where if you go into the dining hall and look at the stained glass windows, you'll actually see stained glass windows of some of the German reformers. Whereas I would go into used bookstores in Oxford and you couldn't find a book from the German Reformation. Hmm. And you'd find all sorts of things from, of course, the English Reformation, but nothing from the German Reformation. And in fact, when you'd get tutors, most of them didn't know much about the German Reformation on the whole, unless you found somebody that was kind of specialized in that. And so it was just really interesting to find a school at Oxford that sort of celebrated that, and that also had called Ferdy to be a tutor for a couple of years. That's pretty high praise, you know, for a sem prof from America to make its way to being a tutor at Oxford University for a couple of years. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's an important aspect of Ferdy's life. You know, he published in English, but his scholarship by the time he was, you know, in mid-career or late career was known worldwide. And so he has written popularly. A lot of his books are really accessible. If you just pick them up on Amazon or off the shelf at a used bookstore, they're quite readable and quite engaging. On the other hand, Ferdy's contributions to the more academic side of things, especially in Luther scholarship and Lutheran theology, in all those ways, he's known around the world. He's respected by Luther scholars in the United Kingdom, in Germany, and especially in Scandinavia as well.
Yeah.
So Ferdy has a sort of international reputation.
Well, we can say from our trips to Norway that he's very well known with the Norwegian Lutherans in Norway. They know his work, man, better than we do. So it's, and I believe some of his books have been translated into Norwegian too, as well as Jim's.
So, yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So let's maybe talk about his work a little bit. I mean, we mentioned that he's a bit of a controversial figure. I wouldn't say that controversy is recent, but I think the ire of the controversy is somewhat recent. I don't think, you know, for a long time, I don't think he was considered a liberal, whereas some people in the LCMS would definitely say that now. I know what I think on this, but it'd be interesting from your perspective. I mean, your dad was a pastor in the ELCA, right? Is now a pastor in the NALC along with you. And so, and you're sort of, it's interesting that, you know, if you came up in the LCMS, I guess the way I'd say it and the way Jim has said it to me has been your cultural history is different than coming up in the ELCA or one of the Scandinavian bodies. And so when I read Ferdy, it was originally one on being a theologian of the cross and two theologies for proclamation. It was a breath of fresh air, and I wasn't really looking for, because I wasn't really aware of his name when I first picked up those books, right? I certainly not to the degree that I am now. I didn't know Jim's name at that point or anything either. And a lot of what he said was just on being a theologian of the cross was just a confirmation of stuff I'd already learned, right? From Rod and other professors at CUI. But theology is for proclamation was a breath of fresh air in that it was sort of, for me, a reformatting of why one might do theology, like why this is important. Because I wasn't a pastor, you know, it had always been, for me, very much a intellectual or academic exercise, this doing theology. But you read Theologies for Proclamation, and you find out how empty the pursuit of theology is if it's simply an academic enterprise and not bent towards the sinner who needs to hear Christ for them. And that sort of the winnowing of the stick to get to the pointy end of it is really to get to the point where the sinner hears the gospel for them. That was utterly refreshing. For me, I read that book at a time when I was kind of getting back into it and really provided, I'd say, a motivation for a lot of what sort of came to be as far as the direction of my speaking and writing from that point. So after reading Theology for Proclamation, I moved on to a couple others, including Where God Meets Man, and got a little bit nervous when reading Where God Meets Man, which I think is sort of him fleshing out several ideas, but really is ideas on atonement, right?
Yeah, so in Where God Meets Man, Ferdy is providing sort of a basic outline of the nature of the Christian faith. The book is meant to be accessible to pastors, and you know, it can be used in churches as well. So it's not a difficult book per se. It might be, but one of the things that Ferdy tries to do in that book is frame the sort of basic Lutheran insight about how God operates with human beings, and he uses the image of the ladder or the staircase. So Ferdy characterizes sort of the typical way that we think about God in terms of going up the down staircase. So if you've ever been out in public, like at a hospital or a stadium or something, and you'll see that staircases meant to move large numbers of people are often divided in two. You go up the right side, you go down the left side, or whatever the case may be.
Or you could think of it in terms of an escalator too. I mean, this is you trying to go up the down escalator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so Ferdy characterizes the sort of typical human religious quest to discover God and find God in terms of going up the down staircase. He also refers to this as the legal scheme.
Right.
So human beings in sin often try to access God by means of their own efforts, by means of their own fallen reason, by means of their own good works. And in the end, what happens is sinners actually end up using the law itself as the way of accessing God.
Right.
So Ferdy's book is in many ways aimed at this view of typical human religious piety as a way of using the law to actually get at God.
And that's that's an interesting thing for people to I think they should grab hold of, is that what he's arguing for is that it's sort of our typical way of doing things as just sinful people is going to be to create some sort of religion that looks very pious, and you know, that we might even call good works, we might even call like a sort of good worship and that type of thing. But when we connect that to our way of accessing God or God's favor, that's essentially a theology of glory.
And identifies all the religions of the world essentially,
yes,
with this, which is something we've done on the show before. Actually, this comes up in our episodes on apologetics all the time, really, right. Is what is the differentiation in Christian theology? And it's not just the tradition or the difference in faith practice, but it's actually the direction in which God comes to us in an incarnate Christ versus us making our way up to God. And some of even the apologetic work we deal with deals with sort of systems of defending God, which try to climb that ladder as well.
Right, which is all good stuff. Where I got nervous is when he connects sort of penal substitutionary atonement or the view of penal substitutionary atonement to this legal scheme. And that's where the Lutheran theologian in me gets a little twitchy. Help me deal with that a little bit, because I think this is where a lot of the objection comes in from LCMS guys for Gerhard Ferdy, is that I think they argue that he tosses out penal substitution, and in doing so, he's tossing out one of the primary ways, if not the primary way, Scripture speaks about how God reconciles, or Christ reconciles us to God through his death and resurrection. So help me out.
Yeah, it seems to me that Ferdy's primary concern is not necessarily with having theories of the atonement, but Ferdy wants us to be curious about how our theories of the atonement can actually end up reinstating what he calls the legal scheme. So we might meditate or think about the death of Christ theologically. And what oftentimes happens is that when we account for what Jesus was actually doing on the cross, we often end up reinserting or sort of going back to this old, typically religious way of thinking about how to connect with God. That is, in terms of...
Somebody's got to do something.
Somebody's got to do something.
Yeah.
And instead of us, perhaps it's just Jesus,
right,
who was sort of in our place playing the legal scheme. Ferdy wants us to get away from thinking in this way, or at the very least be curious about why the cross actually offends us, and the ways in which our strategies to get around it actually end up trying to secure us.
So here's me, right? I'm reading this, and I'm listening. Got Jim in my ear kind of saying very similar things, like that the essentially what this scheme does is that it makes it so that the age-old question, if you could fulfill the law, would it actually save you, is yes, when really the scriptural answer is typically no, Christ saves, right? But here's here's the thing. There's two things I always struggled with this when I'm reading Ferdy, more so I'd say than reading Jim, because Jim doesn't sort of get into the theory aspect as much as Ferdy, I think, does. Is that Ferdy chastises people for using a scheme, right, in a sense, yeah. Or a theory, and then creates a scheme and or a theory. And that's number one for me, is that I always thought, oh, this is problematic, because essentially what you're doing is you're saying this scheme's not going to work. Here, I'm telling you why it's not going to work. And here's the scheme that is going to work. Problem number one, each one is still, I guess, a scheme. And two, I always thought to myself, but what if that's the way the scriptures speak? You know, it's like, okay, you don't like it, right? You don't like it that this scheme has the idea that Christ's perfect righteousness provided the right, you know, provided for your unrighteousness, and that God sees that as good, and then attributes it to you, and that is still sort of a category of the law in a sense, because Christ is perfectly fulfilling the law. You don't like that because you think that falls into these schemes that you connect to all the religions of the world. But what if, my big question always, I'd love to ask him this, but what if the scriptures actually speak that way? Then aren't we sort of at the point where we have to bow to how the scriptures speak on it? So since I can't ask him, I'm asking you.
Yeah, I think for myself, Ferdy is not above critique by any means. And I don't want people to hear us as necessarily offering a sort of total defense of everything Ferdy said or thought. And on the issue of the atonement, I think that there clearly is maybe an underemphasis on some of these themes that you mentioned. But I think that the fundamental aspect of Ferdy's sort of critique of atonement theories is still very helpful, in the sense that he's trying to indicate to us the way in which we flee from the cross, just like the disciples do.
I agree with that. We flee from the idea of being saved because God has decided to save us on account of Christ. We flee from that idea. I don't think penal substitutionary atonement flees from the cross. I think that is one of the things where his examination of that view of atonement is kind of flawed, but it's flawed because of his presupposition that it's necessarily a category of the law, which may or may not be true. But I think it warranted further discussion, which in subsequent time has of course happened, but is happening. But the reason I brought that up is because we are sometimes accused of 1517 of all of our theology being wholly Ferdian and influenced by Ferdy alone. And I thought it would be interesting just to have the conversation to say, you know, I think all of us, including people like you who were, you know, I wouldn't say you didn't have him as you weren't one of his students, but you're certainly influenced by his theology, as am I. You know, we still read this fairly, I read this fairly critically. Like I will love to meet him one day in paradise and to have some of these questions for him.
Can I say one more thing?
About you this? Say, yeah, you're the guest, man.
What I find interesting about this whole debate is that, you know, if Ferdy himself sort of failed to highlight the, you know, penal substitutionary themes in his doctrine of the atonement, I think, you know, one of his greatest students, Stephen Paulson, somebody that we're sort of familiar with around 1517, old seminary teacher of mine, Steve Paulson, in particular, his interpretation of Luther's comments on the atonement in the Galatians lectures. Dr. Paulson has done quite a lot of interesting work on the substitutionary aspects of Christ's death for us. And exactly how Christ dies under the wrath of God, which is exactly the law, and fulfills the law in that way, and then, of course, is raised in victory and imparts the benefits of his death to us. So I would also point to Steve Paulson's work on the atonement in particular as actually a helpful supplement to much of Ferdy's
work as well.
And I agree with that. And I'd even say some of the things that Jim has written in very popular level books, where a popular level book does not allow you to, I'm gonna use this as a critique too, even though I very much like his work, but it doesn't allow you to philosophize as much as some of these works that are obviously intended for theologians and or pastors might. And you know what you get, I think what you get there, and let's just even say in the way that Jim and Ferdy describe the actions of Christ on your behalf in their little catechetical aid, Free to Be. You know, what you get in there is the way these guys thought when they were trying to talk to people instead of to peers. And you get a much sort of cleaner, more down-to-earth version of what Ferdy encourages us to do in theology is for proclamation and to speak of Christ for you in his death and resurrection for you, in his life giving promise for you. And I think that, you know, that's very valuable. Whatever we think about, you know, whether we could critique him or not, or even Paulson, I said this the other day on a sort of Q&A that we did online last night. But one of my biggest frustrations is just being told that I can't read these people, you know, and that's ridiculous. I was taught to learn my basics well. And once I've done that, to feel free to read broadly and then to read broadly and critically of a very diverse and wide breadth of not only theological material, but just material in general, historical, literary, popular, political, whatever. And to then bring what I've learned through years of study as far as critical analysis goes to the fore, but not be afraid to read something under the fear that if I read it, I'm going to just automatically be convinced to hold on to some erroneous doctrine of some type, rather than take what's good and leave what's not helpful.
Which is what we do with anything.
Well, I think it's an adjustment too. And maybe, you know, I think there's like 5 or 6 minutes left here. I think one of the things that might be helpful to tie together of the back of the first half of the show and this second half of the show here, as we talked about Ferdy's context, is that how some of these responses and more theological works happen sort of actually against a political theology and a social theology that were occurring in the ELCA. And that sometimes some of the things in the crosshairs of the legal scheme are actually new laws that he was seeing formed in the synod that he was a part of.
I think that's the most frustrating part of this conversation from people that don't understand that Ferdy, Nestegen, Paulson, you know, they were basically living in a war zone and teaching in a war zone for years, you know, with people that thought that they were, in many ways, thought that they were way too conservative in their approach to reading the scriptures and their approach to the work of Christ and their approach to monergism in general, to Luther studies, to systematics, to politics.
It's really hard for me to take certain criticisms of, you know, Gerard Ferdy or Steve Paulson all that seriously. Especially when the argument's being made is that they're liberals and that they're complicit with this whole story of liberal Lutheran decline in the 20th and 21st century, when they literally fought tooth and nail against the very decline that's being opposed. And so it's really frustrating to see.
And fought behind enemy lines.
And fought behind enemy lines as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think some of the more rigid LCMS-centered critiques see somehow Ferdy's theological critiques as having them, confessional Lutherans, in the crosshairs, where the context of those works and who is actually in the crosshairs are actually sort of a new social justice theology, crafting of new laws that have nothing to do with the atonement of Christ. And so Ferdy is trying to get people to hear Christ rather than a political theology.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it to you this way to sort of orient Ferdy. I mean, here's the handpicked successor of the great Hermann Preuss,
right?
Longtime professor at Luther Seminary, and the seminary educator of both Robert Preuss and and Jack Preuss. Ferdy's credentials in sort of the Orthodox confessional Lutheran milieu or background are pretty sterling. And the fact that he was handpicked by somebody like Preuss to succeed Preuss at Luther is, it's a testament to Ferdy's orthodoxy by and large.
I mean, you just named Robert Preuss and Jack Preuss, who's of course, J.A.O. Preuss, right? If you read any of the books. These are the men that did sort of the fundamental studies on 17th century Lutheranism, the age of quote unquote orthodoxy. And the man that translated Chemnitz Loci as well as Melanchthon's Loci. I mean, just seminal figures in Lutheran theology in their time. And by the way, seminal figures for the LCMS.
Yeah, maybe on another episode we could get into the sort of intertwined histories there a little bit more. I know we don't have time to go into it now, but
so where do we end?
There's a story there for sure.
I think we end this on. I mean, he was a very influential theologian who wrote many things that ought to be read, but like all things, ought to be read with a critical eye. Have your pen and paper ready as you read it, and write down the things that are great takeaways, and maybe even write down some of your critiques to have discussions with beers over friends.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. Hey, John, thanks for coming on this episode, Technical Difficulties and All.
Yeah, well, this was much more than a lot of... So originally when we thought of Thinking Fellows, it was supposed to be people sitting in on a conversation that people might have just sitting around a table. And this was more like that, I think, than a lot of episodes.
Yeah, no, this was excellent. If you have... questions for the Thinking Fellows on this show or any other topic, you can go to 1517.org. There's a contact form there. If you have the means and desire to help support the show, there's also a donate button there on the website, as well as the first link in every show notes is to that too. And we really do appreciate those affordable monthly recurring donations. They help keep the show and the rest of the projects at 1517 alive. And again, we in this hard time for people, we're praying that people have minimal impact on their lives. And you know, if you're struggling with being locked at home or being stuck at home more than you normally would because of COVID, we have been ramping up our production of digital and online resources, and you can find them on our YouTube channel. So you can type in 1517 at YouTube and you can subscribe there. And we've been, again, ramping up that content. And we've also been doing
some... I did a series on the Formula of Concord. I mean, you might want to check it out. It was pretty good.
I heard it was okay.
It was pretty good.
So, hey, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.